The Southern Baptist Convention meets next week in Tennessee, and a growing number of pastors are threatening to leave the group because of allegations of racism.
We have a majority of white men telling black preachers what we can and cannot say. That's hugely problematic and a throwback to slavery times.
Southern Baptist preachers at a crossroads on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is the time of year where it is so wonderful to eat outside. And you take that plate of food outside, and about 4 milliseconds later, you have a bunch of flies on your food, and a lot of us just get irritated and want to swat them away. But we are not Dr. Jonathan Balcom, the author of the new book, Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
I stopped when I was reading this book roughly every 3 to 4 sentences because I came across a fact that just blew my mind, and I got up and I would read it to my husband, and then I would go find my chair again and then get up and read it again. I finally started acting like a fly where I was just sort of buzzing around him at all times with these animals, with these insects. How long have you been fascinated by these creatures?
Well, I'm glad you're getting a lot of exercise.
Yeah.
I've been fascinated with all animals since my earliest memories, and probably insects were among the very first to grab my fascination, because as soon as I was able to walk, I would go out in the backyard and insects are there. As per your comment about having picnics and eating outside, flies are certainly there. Insects are incredibly diverse and successful. They make up 80% of all animal species on this planet. That's just one class of animals makes up 80%. It's estimated there's well over a billion insects per human and approximately 20 million flies, although pretty hard to do the counting. But just suffice to say, they're extremely abundant and they're diverse. As I mentioned, diversity, 160,000 described species. And I say that because it's estimated by entomologists that there's probably about 5 times that many that we haven't discovered yet. And flies are the only insects to be found on all 7 continents. So they're, I think of them as kind of nature's entrepreneurs, opportunists, very successful.
Yeah, they're right up there with the tardigrade, I think. 160,000 described species, 5 times more estimated yet to be discovered. I wonder, just when it comes down to the characteristics that really define what it is that classifies as a new species, what are the main things that biologists and entomologists are looking at for when it is its own distinct species?
Well, it may surprise you that one of the most useful assets or attributes or characteristics of a fly for determining whether it's a member of a previously described species or a new species is their genitalia. Often flies can be so very similar physically to look at, even by experts. But it just probably benefits the flies themselves to have distinctive genitalia, because maybe they make mistakes as well. But if you can't lock your genitalia to the other member of the other sex, then you're probably a different species. So they have very complex genitalia. Many of them do. A lot of species cannot actually successfully mate unless the genitals rotate 180 degrees. Don't try that at home, by the way. After they
unless you
lock
can
together.
Be in Cirque du Soleil.
yeah, maybe there's the exception. But so certainly the private parts of flies are very important in helping to determine what species or what family they might belong to.
Yeah, that was definitely the chapter of the most putting down the book to say, what did I just read? Rotating 180 degrees, there is a fly species with a penis the length of its body. There is a fly species where the females can trap and store sperm from multiple males and then decide which sperm they want to use to fertilize their eggs. There are fly species where their intercourse lasts upwards of 56 hours. Let's talk about that one. What is the genetic advantage? Why is it good for those flies' genes if the sex lasts 56 hours?
Yeah, that's thought to be probably a product of what's called sperm competition among males. By staying inserted into your mate, another male simply cannot get in there unless he can pull the male out or displace him. But because these genitalia interlocks in such a complex manner, that's an unlikely prospect. So one way of keeping other competing males out of the picture is to simply remain coupled to the mate. The well-known love bugs, which are actually flies, they're renowned in particularly in Florida, where they've in the past have been known to gum up car windshields because of their incredible numbers when it's mating time. They are among the record holders. I can tell you that I think it's 59 days is the record for an insect, for stick insects. But one other thing I wanted to mention, you mentioned that, you know, a fly with a penis the length of his body. There's also some kinds of fruit flies who have evolved giant sperm that are up to 7 times the length of their body. It would be like one of a human sperm being the length of a tennis court. And that, too, is thought to have evolved as a means of keeping other male sperm out. Because if you have this, needless to say, these sperm are not lying straight. They're all coiled up like long strands of spaghetti. And it acts as kind of a net, a webbing to block the progress of any subsequent male sperm who might enter the female.
Wow. I'm also interested in there is this is more about the plants in this case, but there is a plant species where the flower design mimics the genitalia of a female fly and then, you know, attracts the male fly, gets the male to pollinate that plant. The role of mimicry in nature is so important. What are some of your favorite examples of the power of mimicry? Now, in my case, this was good for the plants, but for you, good for the flies.
Well, one of the more common types is to mimic animals who stink, animals who will punish any would-be predators, such as a bird who catches a bee or a wasp is going to get stung, and that's a very unpleasant experience. So a lot of flies have evolved to mimic other stinging insects. Flies don't have stingers. Some of them bite, but you know, most of them don't, and none of them have you know, toxic stingers. So looking like a bee is a good way to avoid being preyed upon by an experienced bird who may have had a bad experience or may have just an innate aversion to bees. There are actually some labels on some honey jars that have been printed out with pictures of drone flies, which look incredibly like honeybees on the label. The company selling the honey had no idea that it was actually a fly. And of course, the great majority of consumers would have no idea either, so probably not expect sales. One other kind of mimicry I should mention is there's some flies who look just like spiders and some who look just like ants, which is a good way to avoid prey because ants are toxic or unpleasant food items for most creatures.
Going back to the flies that look like bees, of course, get the lion's share of the credit when it comes to being the world's pollinators. Butterflies get in there, the really, really cutest bird species. The hummingbirds get a lot of credit as well. But flies are powerhouse pollinators, especially that midge fly. What would happen to the world's chocolate supply if we didn't have the midge, the sole pollinator of the cacao tree?
Yeah, flies are champion pollinators and they're unsung heroes. They rank second only to bees and wasps as pollinators. And in cooler areas like Arctic and Alpine environments, they're the tops. I think the chocolate supply would probably go away because as far as is known, there's only one species of insect, and it's called loosely called the chocolate midge, a very tiny little unspectacular fly who's co-evolved with the cocoa plant. And that's the only known pollinator, and it's been quite well studied. It's a devilishly difficult flower to pollinate. And so the chocolate midge, we owe a lot to the chocolate midge for chocolate. We owe a lot to flies in general for a lot of foods that we eat. You know, 90% of the world's 250,000 flowering plants are pollinated by insects. And flies, are right up there as important pollinators. And the estimated economic value of insects for pollination each year is estimated worldwide at over $500 billion.
Wow. I read in the book that some black soldier fly larvae are selling for $330 a ton. Who are the most likely people to be buying these insects?
Well, there's companies now that are starting to breed them in large numbers. One of the pluses of black soldier flies is that they eat compost, and they are incredibly efficient at translating compost, converting compost into animal protein. And so there are some companies, quite a few companies starting up around the world with facilities that are planning to crank out, you know, hundreds of millions of tons of fly larvae or maggots. Mm-hmm. Albeit sterilized ones, as fertilizer, as food for livestock and this sort of thing. I discussed that in one of the chapters in my book, and it's a controversial area, but certainly it's a cheaper and more energy efficient way of producing animal protein than certainly producing livestock.
Do we run into some of the potential problems of overproduction?
Anytime you have large production, there's concerns about the efficiencies. You know, one of the problems with our farming system in general is these monocultures. We grow huge swaths of one crop in big fields, especially in the prairie regions, the former grasslands, and those things are kind of ecological deserts for most species, but they're also bonanza for any species who specializes in that food. Which is one of the reasons why we've used so much pesticides, which is thought to be one of the reasons that insects, unfortunately, are declining quite alarmingly worldwide. Estimated from based on several studies that we've lost about half of all insects on the earth just numerically in the last half century. Mm. So these are big concerns about, you know, producing food for huge numbers of humans on the planet.
We're visiting today with Dr. Jonathan Balcom. He is the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. He is a biologist and has a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. And I read, too, that you have been very involved in the work of, you're the former director of the Animal Sentience with the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy, and sentient being, a creature that can think and feel. And you make a comment in the book that from the point of view of the animal, it is inhumane to consume an animal. But this is within an argument of eating flies. Does this mean that you don't think that insects could be sentient?
Well, that's a great question, and I wanted to get into that a little bit. Sentience, as you say, the capacity to feel, the capacity to, you know, if you're conscious and thinking, it's based on being sentient. And there's been a lot of debate over the ages as to where to draw the line between who's sentient and who isn't. And now there's pretty much no controversy that all vertebrate animals are sentient. And now there's emerging evidence that consciousness has evolved at least twice and probably more than that with the emergence of our awareness that octopuses and squids and their relatives are clearly sentient, even though they're non-vertebrates, they don't have backbones. And there's quite a bit of support now for sentience in insects. It may be a somewhat different type of sentience in certain contexts, but, you know, consider that the flies have an attention span, that mm-hmm. they can get bored with the same visual surrounding. But if you suddenly change the surrounding, their little brains fire up. And they have complicated brains. They have differentiated brains, different parts for learning and memory, you know, central complex for spatial information and organizing movement, a so-called proto-cerebrum, which connects brain regions and collects sensory information. So quite a lot of complexity inside a little animal's head. It's amazing how nature can miniaturize stuff and pack so much complexity into a tiny package. And we have, you know, tool use in ants and digger wasps and assassin bugs. We have mm-hmm. learning, observational learning in bumblebees. We have rational decision-making by fruit flies and this sort of thing. So there's quite a lot of evidence for that insects, including flies, have experiences. And that, of course, leads to ethical questions. I went to an entomology conference in Vancouver while I was researching the book. I know it may have been the first time they'd done this, but they had a whole session on the ethics of insect ethics. And it was very interesting discussions and topics.
Yeah, all of this talk about using tools, making rational decisions, elaborate courtship rituals that can involve even giving gifts or learning dances. And you said that we often associate this sentience with something that is a vertebrate, something that has a backbone. Why did that become where we draw that line? Is it just because those creatures are bigger and therefore easier to study?
Yeah, that's part of it. Another part, of course, is that vertebrates are easier to compare to ourselves.
Sure.
We have a tendency as a species to treat ourselves as the gold standard, the litmus test for consciousness or intelligence. Mm. And, you know, intelligence and consciousness and awareness and sensory ability and sensitivity, et cetera, varies greatly around, depending on what kind of species you're talking about. You know, we certainly have a number of things to be proud of, you know, our culture, our arts, our technology, our music, et cetera. But, you know, we can't smell things as well as a fly can. It can detect a recently dead body from 10 miles away.
Right.
You can't do that. We don't have the sensory sensitivity in that area. And by the way, that's a very useful fact for flies in helping to solve crimes such as murders. You know, fishes can do certain things. I wrote a book about fishes earlier, and they can do things that we can't do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, a little bit of humility, stepping back and realizing that other species and other creatures have their own abilities. But even beyond that, the fact that they are sentient, I think, gives them some moral heft. It means that we do have some responsibilities into how we treat them and how we interact with them.
Of course, the way that we are studying other creatures is coming from an anthropocentric point of view, the point of view of humankind. And therefore, we can say something that looks like us, something that moves like us. It's easier for us to see human-like qualities in those animals. Do you ever do just this thought exercise of what a dipteropathentric, I'm making up that word, I think, but from a fly's perspective, how are they going to study humans?
Yeah, I think some of them take a great interest in us, the blood seekers, you know, the black flies and the horse flies, and of course the mosquitoes, which are true flies. If we disappeared off the earth, insects in general would continue to flourish. In fact, I think a lot of them would be high-fiving each other. They would benefit from our disappearance. But of course, there are a number of species, and certainly flies, who would be very, very disappointed, considering that they collectively humans have about 4,600 square miles of skin surface for biting insects. That would be a big loss for them. But also when we compare them to us, it's surprising some of the parallels when you consider that they have a pleasure system, well, at least the biochemistry that we have for our pleasure system, the octopamine and dopamine, for instance, compounds that are associated with pleasure. Mm-hmm. And they also have motivation. Hungry flies learn better when there's a food reward.
And
things like self-medication. You know, there are flies that self-medicate. They qualify for self-medication. Fruit flies who will ingest more alcohol if they've been parasitized by a tiny wasp. Mm-hmm. The alcohol acts as a toxin. And alcohol is very relevant to fruit flies because they eat rotting fruit, which, of course, ferments, and alcohol is a byproduct of that.
Right. And some species of flies will drink more alcoholic or fermented beverages if they've been turned down sexually.
That's right.
Met a few humans like that.
Like some of us, some disappointed man going to the bar to have a few bottles of beer.
You mentioned that we know a lot about crime solving because of fly species. Take us to your chapter about detectives and doctors. Why is the order in which flies and other insect species colonate a dead body so important to solving crimes?
Yeah, one of the most critical pieces of information toward helping solve crimes is time of death, is estimating when the victim expired. And that information can then be traced back to the location of suspects. And because of flies are extremely sensitive to the smells that of a freshly killed body immediately starts to decay, and these flies pick up on this very quickly, and they arrive on the scene usually within an hour. Well, depending on the species, some of them colonize the body much later in the process. So by looking at the species, the stage of development, and we're usually talking about larval stages here, so maggots, how much they've grown, you can get the baseline data from simply studying these species, and then you can compare what we know, our baseline data, with what we find at a crime scene. And that information has led to hundreds, certainly at least hundreds of convictions, murder convictions, and quite a few exonerations. I describe at length a noted case in Canada. Mm-hmm. So flies are actually very useful in crime solving. And the field is called forensic entomology. And according to one expert I interviewed for the book, she said that the number of forensic entomologists in the world has doubled in the past decade. So this is not a dying art. This is a growing art.
They're useful, too, in terms of waste management. Waste, in this case, being poop. They are coprophagous. Did I get that right? Poop-eating animals.
Yeah, coprophagus or coprophagus. It sounds like a Sesame Street character.
Kind of a gross one. What would happen on this earth if nothing was going after cow dung, for example?
Yeah, flies are champion cleaner-uppers. If it wasn't for their presence, we'd have huge, huge amounts of, as you say, poop and decaying bodies. The average human produces about 20,000 pounds of poop in their lifetime. That's like the equivalent of the weight of three adult hippopotamuses. The world would be a much fouler and more pestilential place if it wasn't for the activities of flies and cleaning up. I used to volunteer at a sanctuary for rescued farmed animals in Maryland. And I would sometimes come upon a fresh pat of cow dung, and already these so-called dung flies were dancing and running around on the surface, doing their courtship displays and fighting over mates. And once that happens, then it's time to feed, and they clean it up pretty fast.
You mention a lot of common names for flies, and they get to be named by whoever discovers them. What are some of your favorite common names for flies?
Well, the common names are descriptive, such as picture-winged flies, which have beautiful patterns on their wings, and they display them kind of like semaphore flags while they're courting or communicating with others. But I think it's the scientific or Latin names that where the scientists get most creative, such as the blowflies, Calophora vomitoria, and Calophora morticia. These are flies drawn to dead bodies. Mm-hmm. And then there's a genus of crane flies with very long mouth parts called Elephantomia. The bee flies named for their sounds, Apolysis humbug and A. zizixensis. And then the Beyonce fly, who has a beautiful bright yellow abdomen, was named for the famous pop star. There are other examples, of course.
What would you name one? I guess that would have to depend a little bit on the quality of the fly itself, but do you have some in your back pocket?
I don't really, but I have a big huge textbook on on all the diversity of flies, and looking through the index, you see some lovely names. One of those ones that I didn't mention is the Quasimodo flies, which have an arched thorax, which gives them a hunchback appearance. Scientists try to be logical when they're naming animals, and of course you have to do your homework and make sure you're not naming something that someone else has already named the same thing or something different. But often their own names or other people's names who they want to honor come into the names, and then often the names are reflective of certain physical attributes, such as, you know, something about the wings or the antennae and that sort of thing.
Dr. Jonathan Balcom is the author of Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects, and it is a fascinating read. I do hope you can pick up a copy, available through Penguin Random House. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Still to come on Main Street, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom as we talk about companion planting. First, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Identity theft is up in North Dakota, that from the 2020 annual crime report from the Attorney General's office.
Anecdotally, it appears that increase in identity theft is a direct result of the fraud that we're seeing with the unemployment insurance that came as a result of the pandemic.
Attorney General Wayne Stengem told reporters a lot of that seems to be coming from out of state.
There seems to be the computer gangs, cyber hackers, who are skilled at making claims for unemployment, taking and getting the money and keeping it. We started finding out about it when, because we're small enough, people were calling and saying, we got a report that employee A was on unemployment and she's sitting right there.
Stengem says his office worked with Job Service North Dakota to investigate those claims. Minnesota lawmakers are heading toward a special session next week, but they're still in negotiations over big slices of the state budget. They need to pass a budget this month to forestall a government shutdown. Talks on education funding have stalled, but GOP Senate Education Chairman Roger Chamberlain of Lino Lakes has made an offer he says is aimed at ending the impasse. His proposal would increase the basic funding formula 3% for the first year of the biennium and 1.5% for the second. He called it a significant compromise.
This is huge. I mean, it's a huge offer, and it's what they've asked for. How they walk away from it, I'm just not sure. So to me, this is a good deal, and it's about as good as it's going to get.
Senate Republicans are not backing off a plan to allow students to attend private school with state money, something Democrats oppose. And Public Service Commissioner Brian Karachas says he understands the frustration of people in the Mayville area who were without power for a couple of days over the weekend. XL says there was a transformer issue at the Mayville substation. Krasha says he's awaiting the results of XL's investigation into what happened to the transformer. He says it is raising some questions.
The key components, are there proper redundancies in place? Do they have the right backup equipment available to quickly move and mobilize to areas needed, as well as the personnel necessary to get the job done? So it's more a matter of looking at future planning and how to better address these types of situations so it can mitigate and greatly reduce, hopefully, the length of time an outage is actually occurring.
Krasha says the XL crews that responded are the unsung heroes in that power outage. He says they work diligently around the clock to restore power. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's lifelong learning community. Information about classes and events at humanitiesnd.org.
Next time on The Pulse, Julie Crystal had been a midwife for over 20 years, but her hospital had never been this busy.
We were just running from room to room, making sure that the baby wasn't about to come out.
The situation was a result of several other hospitals nearby closing, and those closures happened because of financial pressures.
It was stressful, it was scary.
Money, medicine, and the impact on our health.
That's tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Sue Balcom. And instead of normally, as we talk in the Bismarck studio, I actually have the pleasure of seeing her delightful face. She comes to us once a week to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I have the perfect face for radio.
They let you off the farm, huh?
They let me off the farm. Although I'm just all the way to Fargo, I'm thinking to myself, I could be weeding. I could be weeding. I could be weeding.
Classic gardener.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Dig it in the dirt. I watered well and everything because I hate the heat. Like I
get out.
Hate when it's this hot out.
Oh,
so you got to work in the mornings like at 5 a.m.
That is nice. Yeah, I like
that. It's perfect time of day.
Yeah.
The birds are out there singing. Yeah. And then everybody retires about 10 o'clock and then the wind comes up and then it's typical North Dakota
weather.
Then you
take a nap.
Yeah, totally.
We need to get a siesta culture going around
here.
We
do. That and then only working 3 days a week and taking four off. I mean,
Sue, welcome for president. Come on.
All right. Yay. And good food on everybody's table.
Yay.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's talk about growing in the garden, because there are some simple things that we can do to make it either easier to grow good food in the garden or make the food a little tastier in some cases with what we call companion planting. So set us up with a definition.
Companion. Well, good plants make good neighbors. That's just kind of how that goes. And it drives me crazy because, you know, these old Germans used to plant their gardens in just like Army Street rows.
Just like Mother Nature.
Right. And then they had to have like 2 feet between everything so that you could get in there with some kind of like mechanical equipment rather than get down on your hands and knees like I do and become one with the earth while I'm weeding. But companion planting is something that I have a friend that never goes anywhere without her list of companion plants. Now, I've never bought into that to the extent that she does, but there are some things that you don't want to plant next to each other because they do hinder the growth mm-hmm. of a plant. And then there's other things that really actually encourage a plant to be better. But one of the biggest reasons I plant in serendipitous sort of rows is because insects are easily confused by companion planting and plant diversity. You know, so rather than having a field of straight rows of the same kind of crop. Yeah, they love it. Well, they can find it. Like they're flying overhead and they're like, oh, look, you see that dark green strip of spinach down there? Yum! And there they go. And there it's gone. I've already seen flea beetles around on my broccoli plants that I've had to spray. But I did do something different with those this year. I planted cabbage and then I planted two rows of onions and then I planted my Brussels sprouts and broccoli, and then another two rows of onions because the smell of onions deters some of the pests that attack the cabbage plant. So there are some great...
So that's a good example of two things to plant together.
And there are, actually, I would recommend this book, Carrots Love Tomatoes.
Hmm.
This is like a super cool book. It has additional information that we can talk about at a later date, but I'll tell you that there are some plants that grow well with each other. You know, like it says that lettuces are good with cucumbers and carrots. What I did this year was I decided to start my garden a little earlier in the high tunnel. And so I plant peas. Peas are nitrogen fixers so that you will have more nitrogen in your soil after a pea crop. Then they'll be out of the way by the time the cucumbers that are planted just 4 or 5 inches away from them, we'll be climbing up the same fence. So we'll leave the peas, we'll just cut them off at the base and leave the roots in the ground, and the cucumbers can grow up in their place. So there's that to take into consideration when you're companion planting. So it's not just for diseases and for pests, but it can also be beneficial to have a succession garden, meaning that you can start early in the spring and you'll have a different crop every different week to eat. I had to cut my romaine already because it was big and this heat would make it bolt really bad.
Yeah.
But I learned that if you cut it off at the base, it'll grow again. So I'm going to give that a try this year.
Oh, man.
It'll be like awesome.
Yeah.
So now while you can plant cabbages and onions together, you do not want to plant onions and garlic near your peas because they don't produce very well when they're next to onions and garlic. So onions in particular, we have to keep away.
Okay. Well, how about tomatoes? That is a big time favorite. What can we put near them?
What can we put near a tomato? Actually, marigolds. That keeps pests away from the tomato blossoms. And then was it lettuces and lower crops like that? When you have a big crop, tall crop like tomatoes, you plant carrots underneath them. Because they like carrots.
And carrots grow down.
Right. And so then they're kind of shaded by your tomato plants also. If you prepare your fences the right direction, and then you have a cool weather crop that's benefiting from a warm weather crop at the same time. And carrots, of course, your tomatoes are done a long, long time before you ever dig your carrots up. So
sure.
And then, of course, broccoli, carrots don't mind garlic, and they don't mind onions either. Sometimes when you're thinking about companion planting, you want to think about what foods go good together on a plate.
Oh, yeah. Tomato and basil.
Tomatoes and basil, absolutely.
And then I can plant some mozzarella. And
I wish you could plant some. I wish I could plant a cow or two, maybe. I could get some milk. Milk is good, but the cream, yeah, that's what you really want.
Yeah.
So. And, of course, there's different kinds of herbs that you can – other herbs besides basil, things like borage and stuff like that. Mm. Those are to – you know, I always interplant herbs with my other rows of garden stuff because then that way they attract the pollinators, you know.
Okay.
So you always need to make sure that your tomatoes are being pollinated and your cucumbers in particular. If you're not getting cucumbers – you have to go in there like my grandmother did and shake the bushes, like to get a little pollen in the air so that they can pollinate. Your first blooms are male.
Okay.
And then your second blossoms will be the females, and they'll produce the fruit. But they have to cross-pollinate. So you're looking at cucumbers, and you're thinking to yourself, I have 1,000 blooms out there and not a single cucumber in the place. Well, that's because those won't produce until the female plants come out, and then they can kind of, you know, nature is bizarre.
Is there a way to do succession planting with cucumbers so that you get the males and females at the same time?
They're kind of
I don't know a lot about plant breeding, but generally you want males and females involved at the same time.
Oh, and I don't know why the males come first. All the males in my family are always 2 feet behind me when we're walking anywhere. So
you're a busy lady.
But cucumbers, you know, like are kind of they're not an iffy plant. They're you know, they don't like to be transplanted, and they are very particular about. I know people who actually use electric toothbrushes to go around and pollinate their cucumbers to be absolutely certain that they meld together.
Mm.
But yeah, the shaking thing works. I've never had a problem with cucumbers. And the only thing that I know that attacks them, of course, is downy or mildew, you know, like the fungus that grows on the leaves and turns them all white. Downy mildew, something like that.
That's a good question for Ron Smith.
Yeah, I have but I found out that the horsetail that grows in my garden makes a spray that you can use to spray your cucumber plants. And that will take care of that blighty looking stuff.
Okay.
They still grow, but they don't look as nice. And, you know, everything has to have leaves on it so that it can photosynthesize.
How about squash?
What goes good with squash? You know, lamb's quarter. You know, that's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weed.
Yeah. Is that the same thing as wild spinach? Is that lamb's quarter?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Perfect.
And it grows everywhere in North Dakota. It's really easy to pull out of the ground. But I've just recently learned that that actually is very beneficial plant to have as ground cover. So I plant my pumpkins, I plant my squash, and then instead of weeding that bare space, you know, it's like this time of year, you're looking at your garden, you're thinking, look at all that bare ground out there. Should I put some more plants in or shouldn't I? And then by the end of the summer, the vines have taken over the whole garden. But I'm going to leave that. I am not going to weed that out of there. I'm going to leave that lamb's quarter in there because, of course, you put compost in, then sometimes it's not been composted properly. That's what you'll get from it.
Okay. When you say leave it in there, though, you can still be eating it, right? You just want to be leaving the roots
as
in there.
As long as you don't spray your garden with
stuff, there's that,
you certainly can eat it. But and if it bothers you, like some of the gardeners I know are so meticulous about weeding, don't remove it from the garden. Pull it out of the ground and lay it on the ground and let it decompose because then that will add green manure back into your soil again. And eventually I would like to avoid having to shovel you-know-what into my garden So I can just like grow green manure, and then we can harrow that in the fall. And
what does harrowing in mean? Oh,
we don't till our garden, our large garden, with a tiller, because a rotary tiller will cause a hard pan down about 6 inches where the tiller actually hits the ground, becomes really hard, and then your plants don't penetrate that eventually. I don't know how many years it takes, but we use a harrow, which is like fingers, iron fingers on the bottom of our little walk behind tractor that actually just stir the top 4 or 5 inches of soil up, and then we plant in that every year. So
Okay. It's
less destructive to the microorganisms and all those little technical things that I don't know what they're called, but I know they're down there.
I know there's lots of living things.
Yeah, lots of things
good,
down there.
Soil.
So,
okay, so lamb's quarters, and we already mentioned corn goes good with squash.
Well, right, because I was just going to say that the Three Sisters planting that the Mandan Indians used to do, and I come from Mandan Indian country, and it's really cool because besides being nutritionally sound, beans and squash and corn, provide all the nutrients you need to be healthy. They also like each other. So you've got corn, you've got your beans vining up the corn. That makes them grow straighter when they hang down to the ground. Then you've got your squash around there as ground cover. Ground needs to be covered. Your ground should always have something growing in it because that's healthy soil. The soil likes to be covered. Mother Nature sees a bare patch. She's just like I am. She's like, let's get something growing over there. We don't care what it is as long as that ground is covered. Now, if you ever come across a patch of ground that has absolutely nothing growing in it, I wouldn't try to garden there because that means there's totally nothing good underneath the ground there. So,
is there a good test kit out there to determine the health of your soil?
You could get soil samples to see if there's things that are missing in your soil.
Okay.
You know, like if your cabbage doesn't head out, it probably needs lime or phosphorus.
Okay.
To balance the alkaline and the acidity of the soil. But other than that, you can tell your soil is healthy when you can't kneel in it without burying yourself up to your thigh. I mean, that is like, that's good ground there, boy. And so you want to be able to, and there's different soil types. So it would depend on your soil type too. But if you're digging in the ground and you can dig up, you know, 6 or 12 earthworms in a square foot of your garden, you know, you're doing something right.
How about beans?
Beans. Are we talking green beans?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, because I grow some dry beans, too. They like sunflower, you know, something to climb. They like to climb. Now, I know there's bush varieties, too, but they like cucumbers. And I don't know if crops like each other because of their colors. I never thought of that. I bet that would be an interesting thing to think about. But yeah, you can plant your beans next to corn. Beans are pretty, they're nitrogen fixers like peas are. So if you're talking about, you know, planting them and then what you're going to plant next year, you know, you've got soybeans over here and corn over here and in a lot of fields. And then they switch those two crops around because corn likes a lot of nitrogen, so you could plant corn and beans next to each other, which is probably one of the things that the natives did without even knowing it. You know, some of this stuff you just come by accidentally. So,
or by paying attention to what nature is doing.
I know. And that's what I tell people, too. Like, my husband's like, you've got to make straighter rows. You've got to, you know, use the stake thing. And I'm like, God didn't do that. God didn't do that. I mean, look at that. And look at the colors he puts together. That's, like, super cool. And once again, borage. I don't know if you've borage?
Yeah.
Borage is a cucumber from the cucumber family, and it's
that would explain why its leaves taste like cucumbers.
And I love that stuff, like tea made out of borage leaves, and then the flowers are so gorgeous, and then it spreads on its own. I like things that kind of like propagate on their own.
I like plants that survive with benign neglect.
Yes,
I mean you no specific harm, but I'm definitely going to just sit here and pet my cat instead of fussing with you.
Once again, I am the lazy gardener, you know. So back to the peas and the beans, you know, as nitrogen fixers. You know, so plant those next to potatoes or carrots. Most of the things that are in the same family as cabbages, you know, cabbage, turnip, okay. those
cruciferous.
You know what I'm talking about. And then weirdly enough, I know somebody who grows peanuts, which is actually a legume.
You can grow peanuts here?
Yep. Actually, he lives near Carpio, which is near Minot, and he's grown peanuts here before. But they're actually a legume and not a nut. And so they would be the same thing where they would actually add nitrogen to the soil. We like nitrogen in our soil. And don't forget that if you're going to be doing some companion planting, that you might want to incorporate flowers in there too. Like morning glories and pole beans are really good together.
Okay.
Just don't let them go to seed because, like, while they might be reseeding themselves, they might be reseeding themselves excessively if you're not careful about, you know. They become a weed because they're a bindweed relative.
Why would the flowers be good? I mean, I get the marigolds because they can repel bugs, but they, like, what would a marigold do?
Yeah, and they repel deer too, except that the deer went in around the marigolds and ate my flowers off just last night.
Yeah,
feeling like you little.
Careful, the FCC won't let us say what you want to say.
But you guys all know what I'm thinking. Well, maybe not. There's some people who think Bambi is so stinking cute, and I'm like, yeah, not at my house. She's not cute. Like, well, flowers, you know, I think it's their scents, you know.
Okay. Like they're attracting the pollinators.
Attracting pollinators and, you know, and then just being beautiful. You know, like, why shouldn't your garden be beautiful, right?
Yeah.
To me, a messy garden is beautiful. I guess that's a matter of taste then, huh? And trust me when I tell you, I watch for gardens in movies.
Oh, yeah.
So I see these gardens all the time with these straight rows and these great big, huge, perfectly formed heads of cabbage. I'm like, that's not how this looks. I've visited
many
gardens.
That sounds like too much work.
Yeah. Well, and it's just not normal. So
servants to handle that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't get anybody to go into servitude for me. Even if I trade food with them, they won't go into servitude. So
you came in with a couple of handy charts, and I'm wondering where you got these, because we can tell people, you know, until we're blue in the face about companion planting, but
they'll want to see.
You don't
want
to memorize this list. Yeah. So what are some good resources?
The Food Gardening Network. So in addition to having this nice colorful chart, they have all kinds of amazing things, including recipes in there. Mother Earth News, of course, is a really good resource for just about anything gardening. Organic Gardening has a website. That's how I got started gardening. I subscribed to something called Organic Gardening back in the early 80s. You know, like
my grew up garden.
Well, my mom had a garden, you know, so we helped there. And then, of course, whenever I'd rent a place, I would have tomatoes in the flower beds instead of, or pots, you know, that way. So I always had something growing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I had kids and decided not to work anymore, that's when I started really researching, like, the things that we did. And every year it's different. So if you plant something and it doesn't do well for you, then this is why it's critical to keep a diary, too. Like, whether you're companion planting or rotating your crops, all that stuff is really key to keeping a diary. So I've got dates in there when I plant, what I got out of the deal harvesting. And then if something's just not working, then you have to just kind of move it around, you know?
Yeah. The difference between science and messing around is writing stuff
don't
down,
like
right?
Messing around. Yeah, there you go.
Now you're doing science, Sue.
Yeah, I should have paid more attention when I went to high school to things like math and science, because it would have probably come in like really handy.
Yeah, that happens. Sue Balcom joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, once a week to talk about food. Sue, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night.
Absolutely madcap and ridiculous.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Very few things stay funny forever. Python is still funny. They are the secret sextet of silliness.
Join some of the great comic influencers of our time to celebrate Monty Python's Best Bits.
Watch Monty Python's Best Bits celebrated tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 10th. By the late 1800s, Buffalo Bill Cody was nationally known as an Army Scout, hunter, and theater performer. In 1883, he capitalized on that fame by organizing his Wild West traveling show. It included hundreds of cowboys, an Indian village, sharpshooters like Annie Oakley, and a herd of bison. He even took the show to Europe. As the idea caught on, other Wild West shows were soon traveling across the country. On this date in 1908, the 101 Ranch Wild West Show was on its way to Bismarck, but the train transporting the show was involved in a train wreck in Dickinson. The train was stopped when a switch engine ran into it. Four cars were thrown off the track. Four employees of the show were sent to the hospital. The train was late arriving in Bismarck, but got there in time to present the scheduled show. The 101 Ranch Wild West Show got started in Oklahoma when the owners of the ranch, the Miller brothers, were inspired by the success of a neighboring ranch that had created Pawnee Bill's historic Wild West Show. In 1905, the Millers invited guests to come to their ranch to see a show featuring their working cowboys. That evolved into a traveling show in 1907. The 101 Show was unique in that it employed African-American performers. Famous rodeo bulldogger Bill Pickett was a featured performer, as was his brother, who billed himself as a Fiji Indian from Africa. The Wild West shows were popular nationwide, but especially in the East. People thought they were seeing an authentic portrayal of the West. It has been said that Buffalo Bill invented the idea of the Wild West by glorifying hard-riding cowboys, so-called wild Indians, a heroic cavalry, and featuring shootouts and stagecoach robberies. Wild West shows remained popular until the Depression put most of them out of business. But Wild West entertainment can still be found in iconic locations like Medora, North Dakota. And there's always the rodeo, a form of entertainment based on the skills of working cowboys. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
My question is, why does a Q always end with a U?
Have you heard of this book, Who Moved My Cheese?
I wanted to ask about the phrase, do it up brown. I don't hear it at all from my peer group, but I do hear it from older people.
All right, what is that? Where is it from?
Join us this week on Away With Words.
This is a really convincing explanation.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's time for a preview of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We talk with UND philosophy professor and host of the show, Jack Russell Weinstein, about this month's theme, the politics of crisis, how police reform, COVID-19, and climate change are all related. Also tomorrow, Dave Thompson joins us for our weekly news discussion, and Madeline reviews Cruella. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.